You're listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network. Welcome to the V3 Podcast with Dr. Ann Arvizu. Medical affairs innovators are changing the game for business success and making the world a better place for our patients. On the V3 Podcast, we showcase the vision, the voice, and the value of medical affairs. Each month, join host Dr. Ann Arvizu, a globally recognized medical affairs subject matter expert and awarded biotech industry executive veteran, for powerful interviews with today's acclaimed innovators and founders who are leading the profession forward into a new era. These high-level conversations will leave you inspired and equipped with future-focused ideas for changing culture and making an impact. And now, here's Ann.
Well, welcome everybody to episode number 2 of the V3 Podcast. This is the vision, the voice, and the value of medical affairs. If you listen to my first episode, episode number 1, our inaugural podcast, You heard me talk about vision and voice and value. These are three critical factors of leadership. And the leader that I have to interview for you, for our audience today, is Dr. Sotirios Stergiopoulos. He is the Chief Medical Officer and Senior Vice President. He's the Head of Global Medical Affairs and a member of the RDLT, or Research and Development Leadership Team, at Ipsen Biosciences. He has extensive experience in directing medical affairs worldwide in terms of strategies, in terms of plans, in terms of creating a solid foundation with his expertise in oncology drug development. And that really includes everything that we know of about oncology, chemotherapy, immunology drugs, targeted agents across various tumor indications. Dr. Stergiopoulos is also the chair of the board of directors for a young startup company, A2A Pharmaceuticals, which is a fragment-based computational drug design company. Sotirios earned his MD degree at the University of Medical Sciences in Poznan, Poland. He completed his residency in internal medicine at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. And he's also completed a clinical and research fellowship in medical genetics at Harvard Medical School. He's a research fellow at National Institute of Health. He also did his master's in biotechnology, enterprise, and entrepreneurship, his MBEE, from the Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. In his clinical life, he's held the appointment of attending physician in the Department of Internal Medicine at Jacoby Medical Center, Albert Einstein College of Medicine, New York. And he's been a member of the Board of Governors of the Accreditation Council of Medical Affairs, or ACMA. Sotirios is a fellow of the American College of Physicians, the New York Academy of Medicine, as well as the Royal Society of Medicine in the UK. He is also a member of the American Association of Cancer Research and American Society of Clinical Oncology. He is an awarded physician, an awarded thought leader across our industry, and most recently, he's been given the prestigious award by the American Cancer Society for his long-standing dedication to fighting cancer award. Not only does he have all that, he's my friend and he's been my colleague. It is an honor to introduce you to Sotirios Stergiopoulos. Sotirios, welcome.
Thanks, Ann. You almost made me sound good there for a second. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I'm tired. I think I need to take a nap after reading all your stuff. You're amazing.
Incredible. You thought my name was long. Everything else goes with it.
Exactly. Boy, I thought I had a lot of letters after my name. Boy, you do have me trumped. So that's awesome. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really am happy to introduce you to our listeners because you have been an influencer, you've been a colleague, but I also really look forward to picking your brain today on a number of interesting subjects, because there are things that we talk about in medical affairs. And as you know, we've both been in medical affairs for 20 years. There's a lot of rehashed conversations, a lot of same old vanilla. But to survive in our new kind of world economy that we're moving into with data so prevalent and so at our fingertips, with AI, with blockchain, with many of these too much, too fast kind of movement in data, we have to do things in a little bit different way. And I feel like you're going to be able to provide us some very, very interesting insight today. My first question for you is, what do you see for the future of global medical affairs? How quick do you see it coming? And what do we need to do to change, to adapt to the technology at hand?
Thanks, Anne. Great question. But before I answer the question, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me. You know, we've worked in the past together. We've been colleagues and friends, as you mentioned. And it really, it's exactly as you're saying, you know, people are looking at medical affairs still in this, great choice of words, vanilla sort of, manner. But there's so much more to medical affairs, today. And really to be able to just give a glimpse to our listeners, of where things are going, where we think things are going, and really the mindset of people that have been in medical affairs long enough to know the differences is a great opportunity. So thank you so much for inviting me to this.
You're welcome.
I think your first question starting off is already a question that is on point as to how we see the changes in medical affairs going. It's not just who joins medical affairs. It's not just how the organization looks, and which we'll touch that later. But it's also the tools and, you know, the different modalities we can use to be able to help us evolve in a much more efficient manner. And to be honest, in today's world, as we see the more, I would say, you know, utilization of things like blockchain, as you mentioned, or artificial intelligence and, you know, machine learning. It's really a phenomenal era for us. And to say that we are at a point right now that, you know, AI especially is evolved enough for real practical utilization would be not a sincere statement. I think we're getting to that point. Machine learning overall, I think, is still a bit algorithmic considering what we've seen and what we're expecting to see. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't have already great functions in not just medical affairs, but in our industry, in biotech and pharma, whether it's R&D, whether it's in commercial, whether it's in HEOR and whatnot. So I think right now, for medical affairs especially, one of the greatest assets that we have is obviously working with real-world evidence and our HEOR colleagues. Uh-huh. And I think that's really an area where AI can give significant amount of value in the sense that if we're considering some of the real-world evidence out there and how it's being used and what the potentials are for newer therapies coming in, you know, let's say if we want to do a small phase two, and which is a very common thing for medical affairs, you know, we don't have to always now do against an arm that would be, you know, necessary to go out there and find patients prospectively. You know, we can use some of the historical data based on some of the AI that's out there. There's learnings enough that have already been put in place that we can use some of the already generated information to help us. That, of course, makes it a lot more efficient, quicker, but also much more economical to do than ever before. So there's a lot of utilization. Blockchain as well, it's a great concept, one that's already being utilized when doing clinical trials. You know, patient anonymity and you know, obviously the privacy reports and whatnot with blockchain it's a great opportunity to be able to use this sort of crypto machinery to be able to help lock that sort of information for the patient's safety in the long run. So I think, you know, all these sort of newer digital strategies are really just, we're still in the beginning, but we could see where the use will be, where it'll bring medical affairs to the next level. So I'm very excited about it. I don't know about you, but I don't know what you've heard, but at least from my colleagues out there, I have a couple of great colleagues out there, Jen Chun from Merck and some others who are already on top of it. And you could tell that there's a tremendous amount of excitement. About a couple of months ago, I was actually invited to an AI consortium meeting at Harvard Medical School, which I gave a talk, and I was one of the panels. And really, what you see is people are just chomping at the bits to get to this sort of technology. It's becoming a much more efficient way, effective way, economical way, and just the way of the future. And of course, medical affairs is right there in the lead doing this. So very exciting times for us.
That is exciting. You know, blockchain, if people don't know that it's beyond cryptocurrency, they're kind of behind the learning curve in terms of how it is being used for patient data, data analytics, data management. It is, like you said, it is a mover in our industry. And yet, when you look at all of the big picture, whether it's blockchain or if it's AI technology, people and companies, industries actually as a whole, it's been shown that biotech, life sciences, and healthcare, we rank among the lower quadrant, the lower quarter quadrant of users. So for example, media, entertainment, telecommunications, technology, professional services, industrial products, you know, you see it on your phone, you see it on your car, but we're not seeing it as much being invested in. So you mentioned something that I thought was really interesting is that it's economical. And that it does have an impact. And so what is it? Is it that our industry as a whole is kind of lagging behind in terms of, is it lack of knowledge? Because it's not necessarily lack of relevant application, but it could be maybe systematic lack of knowledge in our industry. What do you think?
No, you really bring up a key, I think, human behavioral issue more than anything else. I don't really believe it's because of any of the above. I think it's more of we are in the critical stages of these trials and those trials. Do we interrupt and introduce a new way to do things, or do we figure out another way to do it? And I think, like Ipsen, I'll give you an example. Ipsen, for the most part, you know, we said, okay, there's so many companies out there now that are coming up to us about the utilization of these incredible digital technologies. And so what we said is, well, we won't use it for the studies that were currently ongoing, which are quite important to us. And obviously, we don't want to interrupt or cause any hesitancy because, as you know, time is of the essence in getting approvals and obviously finishing up your data and moving forward. But what we're doing is we're looking at some of the older studies that we had, very influential studies, and seeing if we had applied these sort of modalities in there, what would have been the outcome? Mm-hmm. So I think what's going on is it's the industry is pressure testing it, right? It's checking to see if, is this a fad or is this real? Is this really going to change things or is it just lingo that's out there? You know, and people are concerned with the fact that this is still quite new. And there isn't a lot of information already put in there. One thing, you know, people have to understand, especially in our industry is, you know, it's the use of, let's say, AI is only as good as the information that's been put in there to really use machine learning. Because until we get to real machine learning, it's really algorithmic.
Right.
It's just following the old steps of, you know, if this, go to this, if this, go to that. It's only until we've had enough data and enough information in there that we can actually call it machine learning. Mm-hmm. So I think it's still in its infancy in one way or another. You're absolutely right. We're probably lagging in compared to other industries. But I think it's one where once we see the absolute benefit of having this, you know, you're going to need an egg timer because it'll just go quick.
Yes.
You know, people will just adapt to it quickly. I think one of the greatest things that I've seen is the new CEO of Novartis, Vas, and I can't remember his last name, very long Indian name, just like myself, a long Greek name. Mm-hmm. But Vas was the CMO of Novartis. And one of the things he said is, like, we got to introduce digital stuff sooner than later.
Yes.
That move on his own, you know, really that push, number one, it showed the importance of using this in medical and clinical in general. But then also that big companies and strong companies out there with a great reputation are really putting a huge emphasis on it, which means it's almost given its validation in that manner. So I think other companies are looking at this go, oh, wait a second. You know, we shouldn't be held behind here. We should be really moving forward as well. So I think that lag time is now that we see, but it's a very, very short time before everyone's going to be using it.
Yeah.
And I think all companies are going to be saying, we can't be the last in there. We're, you know, there's way too much to lose here if we do that.
Right.
So, you know, I think before you know it, everyone's going to be in. And really, if we see the benefits of it and people really get to see what the benefits of it, it'll even adapt to a whole different level and evolve to a whole different level than we ever expected.
Right. Now, in terms of a small pharmaceutical company, right, you're in what I would call a small to mid-sized pharmaceutical company, but the small startups, the biotechs, like the one that you're serving on the board, for example, or others, I get calls all the time from these small companies. They're 200-300 people. And they're, you know, what are the key parts of medical affairs, they ask? And what are, you know, what are the key business cases that we need to put together to move the needle in our industry, to get the funding we need to kind of convince senior leadership of this? So how do we close, like you said, it's a behavioral awareness. It's also a skills and capability awareness, a cognitive effort within our company. How do we close the skills and knowledge gaps so that we can provide that value and that we know what we're talking about? Because the early adopters, maybe to this technology, like you mentioned, the Novartises of the world, maybe they have a chief information officer who's bringing something to the table. What are you seeing at the leadership level in the C-suite that, you know, what kind of conversations would support the movement to say this can happen? Because I think people maybe in middle management, directors, senior directors, vice presidents, they might not know what is that secret sauce that I need to say, oh, there's this technology. Now, how can we initiate?
It's ironic, actually, to be honest. It's what we see is actually middle management, you know, the technically savvy people, the ones that are, let's say, the content experts. They're the ones that are actually keep pushing that we need this more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think C-suite agrees to it to a certain extent, but they also have to have a big picture of what's going on, a much more broader view, look at budgets, you know, look at how things will have to move to that next level. You know, if we're concerned about what phase threes are coming out and how that is going to affect the company, what are the analysts going to say? What is the stock going to look like? So all these things are on the C-suite's mind, right? Whereas the more content experts and the ones that are really driving the work
right,
are the ones that are pushing for it. And mm-hmm. It's incredible. You know, we have our big digital push is coming out of R&D with our head of biology that's actually doing it. And, you know, he's so savvy in this and he sees it, you know, that he's been pushing like you can't imagine. And it's only until, you know, like the head of R&D really saw the benefit on this and then brought it to the executive leadership team and then really said, guys, we have to do this. You know, some of the aspects that were really brought forward as concern would be also in the, you know, the safety component, the pharmacovigilance and where we can better what we're doing there and with the information that we're getting on our safety profile and how that could be sort of brought to that next level so that we're already ahead of the curve.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what I found was middle management, the technical people were the ones that pushed it and brought the alert to the leadership teams and the C-suites. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really how things happen. Mm-hmm. You know, the ones that are really doing the significant amount of work to bring the data are the ones that are looking constantly for the better way to do it. And once they find it and they see the benefit of it, they start yelling. You know, they're at the on the rooftop screaming off the top of their lungs. And that's how I think for the most part in our company, we now have a chief digital and strategy officer. In Ipsen, and we see the utilization there. And we're seeing much more of an emphasis with resources and people going behind it. And I've been pulled into a million meetings so far on, you know, which companies would be best, what are their scientific platforms, what are they doing to make it better? And that all came from push from middle. So it's not the way you would imagine it. You know, you figure the C-suite would know, and then they push it on everyone else, but it's the other way around. The awareness came from, you know, from the middle. And okay. I find that absolutely wonderful and reassuring that our people are doing the right job.
I do too. In fact, for me, that's a very refreshing answer because we are the ones hearing about it, right? When I was a global leader of a subject like medical information or globalization of your literature teams, et cetera. And you're seeing these different applications. Now, you know, with RxDR Communications, I shared in the first episode, small companies are coming to me, innovating companies saying, how about we, if you could beta test this chat bot thing with us, it's a new application, we're creating it, and we can get this chat bot to answer all of your medical information questions that we can program, right? It's not going to replace, but it is going to augment how patients are looking for digital answers, how they are, you know, existing and communicating in this digital world. It also gives an element of trust to the organization. So when we see these things, we want to implement them. And I think that for our listeners that fall into that category, I think the message is and the advice is be bold and bring it up, create a good business case, do your due diligence, find out the companies, and then take it to whoever is that, you know, head of medical affairs or the digital strategy officer or the chief information officer, IT, and don't let it get crushed in the middle management. Bring it to the table because they're the ones going out, they're at the conferences, they're hearing the new technology, and we're seeing it just fly. You know, people who are thinking, oh, we need to still implement AI. I'm sorry, you're already lost. AI is here. It is mainstream, right? Now we're moving into other technologies already. So,
right. So
I love that.
And
I love
that. It's actually funny. People don't even realize they're utilizing AI right now. Mm-hmm. You know, you're using some of the vendors that are utilizing AI. And if you think that some of the answers you're getting back are purely from a database that they created alone and have kept there forever, then you're sadly fooled on this. So mm-hmm. it's funny what people don't really know is happening. I had the pleasure of going and attending a lecture by Peter Diamandis, who is the CEO of the XPRIZE Foundation. And if you don't know what that is, please look it up. Singularity okay. University is a group that it's a university they've opened in California. And the XPRIZE Foundation is a wonderful organization that mm-hmm. has gathered funds. And what they do is they put out let's say competitions about the most unimaginable things that could happen. And yet people go out there to compete for $10 million, $20 million. They actually spend about almost $100 million to get it. And they do, like, you know, what is the next best possible way to get to the moon or Mars? What is the best way to make sure that we will always have water, drinking water for God knows how many generations? So part of it is a lot of the applications of these digital modalities that we're talking about that we don't think that we're using every day anyway. So I think once mm-hmm. people see this, then they start warming up to it much, much more. And then, like I said before, if you see every other company is doing it, you're the last one, then God help you. Because in essence, I think the last thing you want to do is be the last one at the table. If there's anything left, good luck.
Yep, exactly. Thank you so much, because I think that just having this conversation today, we're helping to build awareness and education of what exists and what is coming. And let me just switch gears for a minute and just ask you, what do you think, in light of all this, are the critical roles that medical affairs really needs to focus on or adopt moving forward as kind of a necessary, just, yes, we're the compliance, you know, factor for the company, but we're also strategic drivers in the company. We're decision makers, yeah, and we're a source of trust for our patients ultimately. So in that light, talk to us.
So, Anne, I mean, you know, you have a firsthand view of what I did at Ipsen with medical affairs and global medical affairs. It's very, let's say, sparsely resourced area of the company. And the things that I identified are the most important to be able to really bring a significant amount of value to the organization in the name of medical affairs. Obviously, patient centricity is one of them.
Yeah.
And it's one of, you know, it's not a catchphrase. You know, I see a lot of people use patient centricity as a means of, hey, if I say that we're patient centric, that means we're legitimate. Well, no, there's a lot of work that goes behind that. And we could talk about that as well.
Right.
But then there's also the, what we call the medical affairs services. And I think that area is pretty much the heart of medical affairs and what they bring to the table, mm-hmm, whether it's medical information, which, yeah, you know, well, how important that is to the organization, publications. You know, it is one of the most valuable tools a company has to be able to, you know, data disseminate, which is absolutely important, but not only data disseminate, but also, you know, give feedback on patients' views, get a sense of where is it that we need more information on, or where are we getting more information. Mm-hmm. So publication is a key area. Medical communications, which another area, and the ability to have necessarily the right people that will, you know, help with the outreach to KOLs and or TLs, whatever the lingo is today, and be able to do it correctly and make sure that we get the necessary information, build those relationships. So medical affairs services, I think, is the heart and soul of any GMA. But then when you look at all that, obviously your therapeutic areas are key to make sure that they're strong and they have the information they need and are able to have the discussions with your thought leaders and KOLs and really be understanding of the content and really be experts in it. Then I think really it comes down to the control of the local medical affairs, where, right, I find that the MSLs are, I think they're the biggest strength/weakness of any company. Because the right MSLs, the rightly trained MSLs, the MSLs that know how to be able to speak out there, not only have the technical skills, but also the soft skills to be able to have and maintain those relationships, they can make you or break you.
Yeah.
And they are the front of the line. They are the fighters in the trenches. They're the ones that need our most support out there. So if you were to ever say to me, you know, give me three things that GMA needs to really, really make sure they have, is number one, it is to have a strong medical affairs services. Number two, own the content expertise. And number three, make sure that their MSLs are top notch. If you don't have this, you just don't have a medical affairs. You might as well call it anything else, but it's not going to be medical affairs.
Right. And you know, you didn't mention the strategy section, right? The TAs. There's an entire internal engine behind those medical affairs. And I think sometimes outside the industry, or if you're new to the industry, you're just getting in, you don't understand, or maybe you think of medical affairs just as the MSLs. I see a lot of companies that are small companies, startup, preparing for their first launch, and they'll have the entire exo structure set up, but they have no infrastructure set up. And there is, you know, it's a shell, and that shell is going to crumble, as you say, if you don't have all of those pieces working together in harmony. So our medics that are defining strategy, that are creating those phase two studies, that are driving, you know, grants and working with KOLs and creating those studies and publications, and our internal team that drives it. Just so if you don't know what that language is that Dr. Sergiopoulos is talking about, but what our medical affairs services internally are, the medical information, medical communications, medical governance, doing clinical trials or clinical trial operations that are post phase 3B. So this is for products that are already out in the market, right? In my early career, I spent 6 years in R&D, right? That's when we're creating the clinical trials and we're getting it ready for whatever Ministry of Health to approve or the FDA to approve, for example, in the U.S. But after a product is out on the market, and these days it's not just drug, it's product, it's also therapy, because we're in the age of gene therapy. We're in the age of very interesting rare disease and potential cures. So it's a really exciting time that we're in for the patient. And so you mentioned that with patient centricity. Let's take it back to, what is your definition of patient centricity? And how can we, in all those functions that we just mentioned in medical affairs, ensure that these different pieces are all focused on the patient?
Yeah, you know, like I said before, patient centricity has been used as a catchphrase, and it's disturbing, but I think we're moving in the right direction now. I think we have some wonderful patient centricity offices out there that their whole goal is to make sure that, number one, most importantly, internally, the company realizes this is all about the patients, okay? And it's a huge effort to do. Don't forget, years ago, not even years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we didn't have the thought of the patient immediately in our, in our design of a clinical trial or program for that would actually work in some sort of clinical development for an asset. It was never thought that, you know, to get the viewpoint of the patient advocate, the patient themselves, you know, people that were spokespeople for the illness based on the patients. And, you know, that sort of mindset and thinking was quite archaic. What we see more and more now, I'll give you Ipsen as a perfect example. So our Chief Patient Centricity Officer, who reports to me as the CMO, her goal is, number one, educate everybody within. First of all, you know, go to the R&D, make sure they understand that the patient's voice should be heard. Make sure the regulatory understands that as well. Make sure the commercial people, and that it's not only a way of approaching advocacy groups only because it's going to help us partner and then it's going to wind up selling our drug. That's not what it's about. It's getting the voice of the patient in there. So we've had a very, very strong chief patient centricity officer that has done an incredible job. First of all, more importantly, educating within and then going out and making sure that we are having some wonderful discussions. In fact, you know, we have some great relationships with the Pancreatic Cancer Network, PanCAN, with IKACSS, with the International Kidney Group, and it's just a phenomenal amount of rapport. But it's more about, how do we get the voice of the patient? One of the things that we see more and more now is that even in the global project teams, which is led by the development group and their project team person, they have the patient centricity person involved in there to make sure that we get an understanding of what the patients want. And our goal, I mean, where I see the future going is one day when we show up to the FDA about a study design and we say, these are the outcomes and the endpoints that we see valid. And they challenge us on us and say, no, not this one. We'll say, no, our patients told us that this is important to them.
Yes.
That they finally realized that that's the voice of the patient. So patient centricity will be, I think, effective when we start seeing that sort of level of voice of the patient within and without and outside of the company. So our goal is make sure everyone understands from the beginning that even our objectives, our annual objectives, have something to do with patient centricity, but that we are hand in hand with the patient to get their voice included in everything that's done. Once we have that, that's success to me. That's when we really have a real patient-centric program in the company.
Right. You know, one of the tracks that I'm chairing at the upcoming DIA meeting in March in Orlando is a patient centricity track. And we're taking, for the first time, a subsection of people from across medical affairs. We're taking someone from the TA, someone from the field, someone from MedInfo, MedCom, and someone from medical writing, and saying, how are you patient-centric? How are you strategizing yourself or identifying yourself as patient-centric? I have walked down the halls in a pharmaceutical company and been stopped by someone who was in grants, and they thought, I just write grants. I just help, you know, people with ISSs, and that's all I do. And I'm like, what do you mean that's all you do? If you didn't help push that grant through for that investigative physician, that patient wouldn't be in a new trial that's being designed. And this is innovation, and this is a way forward. This is a solution on top of a solution. So this is really important. And how would you say that you give advice maybe internally for people to identify themselves as patient-centric?
You know, a lot of it is mindset. You know, a lot of it is really having an understanding of, you know, your work and your focus isn't just on whatever's written on that paper. It's mm-hmm. the heart behind it. It's the understanding of what you're writing on there that can make a change and really alter, you know, the direction of where we're going, as long as it's understood that you're including the patient's mindset in there. So even the person that just does the ISSs, you know, if they are looking at it and they're looking at the potential of what endpoints in this, if they feel like this, the voice is missing there, they could say something about it. They could do something about it. So I think it's really just having that in the back of your mind at all times and making sure that you have some sort of radar vision to say, hey, you know, this is missing. This isn't here. You know, I don't feel it here. Then it's probably not there.
Right.
So if anything, it's like the absolute time of anyone and everyone within the organization can play a role for patient centricity. It's all a matter of mindset.
Right.
And if they believe they will have the patient in best interest and mind when they're doing their work, it'll show.
Excellent advice. Would you bring it home for us? Pull on our heartstrings for a moment. Give us a really great patient centricity example that has been maybe something in the oncology sector or something that has maybe passed through Ipsen's halls that you had played a role in.
You know, there's so many little things that we've done that I feel play a huge role. So, you know, I can say that, you know, PanCAN, the Pancreatic Cancer Network in the U.S., they're about to start running something called Precision Promise, which is a form of running clinical trials, looking at what would be the best treatment out there for pancreatic cancer. And as many may or may not know, we have a compound, a nanoliposomal irinotecan called Onivyde, that is approved in second line for pancreatic cancer post gemcitabine based regimen. So we already have something there, but we are looking at more ways to increase more treatments. So we are working with the PanCAN group to see the best possible way. And right now, we have a compound that it's a systemic radioactive therapy, radiation therapy, that we feel can also play a role there. And we sat with the Pancreatic Cancer Network, sat down, we talked about it with them, went through it. We had discussions with experts, part of their consortium, and everyone believes that this is worth looking at. So we're showing our dedication to making sure that a disease like pancreatic cancer is going to be, you know, obliterated and thrown out. You know, the unfortunate part is that in the past, I would say 30-something trials that have looked at potential treatments, almost 99% of them failed. And this is, pardon the term, it's a graveyard for treatments in pancreatic cancer. So what we're looking at is potentially finding more than one ways to treat a very ugly and really difficult disease that we, you know, are just so glad that we could play any role in. You know, so for us, working close with a patient organization to do this is really one where we feel that's the way it should be done. You know, we should be working hand in hand to really get what's best for the patients out there. So for me, you know, and you know, you may know Ann, but you know, my mother passed away 2.5 years ago, pancreatic cancer. And then 9 months later, my first cousin did as well. And, you know, it's a disease that's really close to my heart. So seeing a company like Ipsen do that, you know, the dedication, it's just incredible to me. That's really taking the patients into account and really, really working closely with the patient groups to be able to make something happen. So I think, you know, that doesn't show a patient-centric focus. I don't know what does.
Absolutely. When you're talking about that and those initiatives and the ugliness of that disease, the painfulness, and I'm picturing a pancreatic cancer patient that I saw 25 years ago in a hospital on rounds in, you know, my postdoctoral fellowship or what have you, and remembering, I don't even remember the exact hospital I was in, but I remember that patient. And I remember him actually dying in the room that day after the exam and myself and medical students around me. And it is really, there hasn't been a lot of progress, but that's the person that I would hold in my mind when I saw that. And like you, you know, I didn't have a parent that died of pancreatic cancer, but the fight against cancer is so real and it's so prevalent in our society. My mom died of breast cancer. My dad died of lung cancer. And it sobers you for a while. So I've been proud to work with companies and work for companies that have oncology products. So I want to just tip my hat and say thank you for all you do in terms of our patients and relentlessly trying to move the needle forward in terms of how can we get more new and innovative therapies? What is the next wave? Like we talked about blockchain and AI and technology and moving maybe how we do business, but how we do therapy is real as well. There are new types of technologies out there. Tell me about something new in terms of technology that people in medicine or pharmacy really aren't aware of.
You know, you know, you go back to something like AI. And, you know, most people don't know that right now it's actually being utilized in hospitals as well. Mm-hmm. AI, especially in radiology, is probably the area that it's more developed in versus others. You know, we see AI from, you know, drug creation all the way from the beginning, all the way to, you know, being used later on with information for how to be able to provide information on an arm, you know, in the clinical trial and get some historical perspective versus then the utilization out there for patients. And what most people don't know that radiology has actually moved forward. Many hospitals actually have right now for the gastroenterology suites, where if someone's being scoped either above or below, either colonoscope or a scope above or esophageal scope, what happens is there is a certain, let's say, camera on there that utilizes AI and can tell you which polyp is most likely cancerous to be able to pick it off and then do the analysis so you get much more of an understanding.
That's fantastic.
And imagine how many of those have been done. to be able to get that sort of information. So that's an area where I could say a lot has been done. And the recognition of what the polyp looks like allows for the machine to tell you, no, that's most likely cancerous. Take that one versus no, that one's fine. Leave it alone. You know, back in the day, you'd have to pretty much cut all of them. And if there was 50 in them, you'd have to go for all 50 so you can get a sense of what's going on. But imagine now that you're much more focused. You can hone in on the area that you need to get the information to be able to do the treatments they need to get. So just incredible where we're going. So I think, you know, AI is becoming really a big deal. We're still in the infantile stage there, and there's a lot more learning, human learning as well as machine learning. But we will get there. We will get there. I think it's going to be the area that's going to take us to that next level.
That's so exciting, Sotirios. Just a couple final questions. What keeps your heart in the game, and what energizes you when you deflate a bit?
Oh, you know, one of the things that I've complained this to my family a few times, you know, I gave up seeing patients about a year ago. And really for me, you know, seeing the patient just kept giving me that energy. But to be totally honest, realizing that what we do and the ability to touch so many patients on a more grander scale is, I think it's the motivator. It's knowing that, you know, even if we're working on a rare disease where we only see it, you know, one in 100,000 or one in a million, you know, but they're out there and we find treatments for them and we take care of them. That's, you know, a certain cohort of people out there that we know can now be taken care of. And for me, being able to have that broad ability of touching lives on that scale is just, you know, it's incredible. So as a physician, it's extremely rewarding. And I must say, though, that every morning when I get up, I really don't feel like I'm going to work. It's that old saying, right? Do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. And really for me, it's, you know, it comes down to how many patients can we touch? How many? And, you know, you don't realize it because, you know, some of these patients just being treated, you know, somewhere in Tennessee. So how do you know them? But I can tell you so many times people that have contacted me that have said, oh, you know, my my mother-in-law got this treatment. And I'm like, what treatment did she get? Oh, she got this. Oh, you know, I worked on it. Oh, really? Yeah, absolutely. You know, that gratification, you know, from somebody you don't even know, but you touch their lives. I think it's just what keeps me going in the long run. And it's a privilege and an honor to actually work in an area in the field where you could touch so many people and never even know it.
Yeah, it is a privilege. It's an honor. And it comes from your heart. So, you know, I want to just acknowledge you with the fact that I call people like you a corpreneur, right? The corporate entrepreneur. And you feel that you have this core-centric approach, right? This core-centric approach that is at the heart of all you do is really your patient. At the heart of what you do is service to the world, and you're giving something to the world. So we want to just thank you for that today, acknowledge you for that today, and, you know, take that into your weekend and marinate a little in that, you know, just we are out there as road warriors. And I know that you probably see more airports than you do your own home. And, you know, that is not something that we should take for granted in the industry with people like you who are movers and shakers and constantly on the go for what you do. So thank you. Hats off, Sotirios.
I must say, though, it does help to have great colleagues and great friends such as you, and for really bringing this sort of understanding out there. And I think it's great. Podcasts like these are wonderful. I think it gives people an understanding from not just, you know, to say, oh, this guy's a CMO, so he's going to tell me something on the CMO level. I can tell you that I have the same conversations throughout the levels. And it's what I find is the level of dedication does not in any way change because you're a C-suite, middle management, lower management, or just the technical worker. I think without all of us being dedicated, all of us really putting our hearts into it, it doesn't work. So I kudos to all. And really just, I hope we all keep the fight because one day we will beat this. We will beat cancer and every other disease out. It's up to us.
It is. Thank you. So inspiring today. Sotirios, you deserve a great weekend off. And I just want to thank you. I'm honored that you would be my very first guest in terms of my first interview on the vision, the voice, and the value. Thank you so much. What a wonderful and engaging conversation we had today with Dr. Stergiopoulos. I am really excited that we really hit all of our touch points for the podcast today. I hope as a result of today's call that you've learned to keep your vision focused and clear, that you're going to be bold and let your voice be heard, and you're going to be the source of value for our patients and our profession to move it forward. Please feel free to share this podcast on social media, and please use two hashtags when you're doing so. Hashtag V3Podcast, that's V as in voice, 3Podcast, and hashtag medical affairs, so we can find each other across social media. If you want to be an upcoming guest on my show, go ahead and in-message me on LinkedIn and or on Twitter. You can find me at my name, Anne Arvizu. That's AnneArvizu. Thanks for listening today.
Thank you for listening to the V3 Podcast, part of the ACMA Podcast Series, in collaboration with the Pharmacy Podcast Network. For all of the ACMA podcasts, please go to acmapodcast.com.